pulling and looped the rope a few times around a radiator pipe. She tied it with a clove hitch. Then she vanished from his field of vision. She was gone for more than 15 minutes. When she came back, she pulled up a chair and sat in front of him. He tried to avoid looking at her painted face, but he could not help it. She laid a pistol on the living room table.
His pistol. She had found it in the shoebox in the wardrobe.
A Colt 1911 Government. An illegal weapon he had had for several years. He had bought it from a friend, but never even fired it. Right before his eyes, she took out the magazine and filled it with rounds. She shoved it back in and cocked the weapon. Sandstrom was about to faint. He forced himself to meet her gaze.
"I don't understand why men always have to document their perversions," she said. She had a soft but ice-cold voice. She held up a photograph. She must have printed it from his hard drive, for God's sake.
"I assume that this is Inez Hamujärvi, Estonian, 17 years old, from Riepalu, near Narva. Did you have fun with her?"
The question was rhetorical. Sandstrom had no way of answering. His mouth was taped shut, and his brain was incapable of formulating a response. The photograph showed...
Good God, why did I save those pictures?
"You know who I am?"
"Nod." Sandstrom nodded.
"You're a sadistic pig, a pervert, and a rapist."
He made no move.
"Nod."
He nodded. Suddenly he had tears in his eyes.
"Let's get the rules of engagement 100% clear," Salander said. "As far as I'm concerned, you should be put to death at once. Whether you survive the night or not makes no difference to me at all. Understand?"
He nodded.
"It has probably not escaped your attention that I'm a madwoman who likes killing people. Especially men."
She pointed at the recent newspapers that he had collected on the living room table.
"I'm going to remove the tape from your mouth. If you scream or raise your voice, I will zap you with this."
She held up a taser.
"This horrific device puts out 50,000 volts. About 40,000 volts next time, since I've used it once and haven't recharged it. Understand?"
He looked doubtful.
"That means that your muscles will stop functioning. That was what you experienced at the door when you came staggering home."
She smiled at him.
"And it means that your legs will not hold you up, and you will end up hanging yourself. After I've zapped you, all I have to do is get up and leave the apartment."
He nodded.
"Good God, she's a fucking crazy killer."
He could not help it. The tears flowed uncontrollably down his cheeks. He sniffled. She got up and pulled off the tape. Her grotesque face was only an inch from his.
"Don't say a word," she said. "If you talk without permission, I'll zap you."
She waited until he stopped snuffling and met her eyes.
"You have one chance to survive the night," she said. "One chance. Not two. I'm going to ask you a number of questions. If you answer them, I'll let you live. Nod if you understand."
He nodded.
"If you refuse to answer a question, I'll have to zap you. Understand?"
He nodded.
"If you lie to me or give an evasive answer, I'll zap you."
He nodded.
"I'm not going to bargain with you. There will be no second chance. You answer my questions immediately or you die. If you answer satisfactorily, then you'll survive. It's that simple."
He nodded. He believed her. He had no choice.
"Please," he said. "I don't want to die."
"It's up to you whether you live or die. But you just broke my first rule. You do not talk without my permission."
He pressed his lips together.
"God, she's completely insane."
Blomqvist was too frustrated and restless to know what to do. Finally he put on his jacket and scarf and walked aimlessly to Södra station, past Bofilsburger, before he ended up at the Millennium offices on Goethegarten. It was perfectly quiet. He did not turn on any lights, but he did put on the coffee maker and then stood at the window looking down at Goethegarten. He tried to put his thoughts in order. The murder investigation was like a broken mosaic in which he could make out some pieces, while others were simply missing. Somewhere there was a pattern. He could sense it, but he could not figure it out. Too many pieces were missing. He was assailed by doubt. "She is not a deranged killer," he reminded himself. She had written to tell him that she had not shot his friends. He believed her. But in some unfathomable way she was still intimately involved in the murders. Slowly, he began to re-evaluate the theory he had clung to since he walked into the apartment in Enschede. He had immediately assumed that Svensson's investigative reporting about sex trafficking was the only plausible motive for the murders. Now he was coming to accept Bublansky's assertion that this couldn't explain Bjurman's murder. Salander had told him in her message that he should forget about the Johns and focus on Zala instead. Why? The damn pest. Why couldn't she tell him anything that made sense? Blomqvist poured coffee into a young left mug. He sat on one of the sofas in the middle of the office, put his feet up on the coffee table, and lit a forbidden cigarette. Björk was on the list of Johns. Bjurman had been Salander's guardian. It could not be an accident that Bjurman and Björk had both worked at Seppo. A police report about Salander had disappeared. Could there be more than one motive? Could Lisbeth Salander be the motive? Blomqvist sat there with an idea that he couldn't put into words. There was something, still unexplored, but he couldn't explain exactly what he meant by the idea that Salander herself could be a motive for murder. He experienced a fleeting sense of discovery. Then he realized that he was too tired and poured out his coffee, rinsed the machine and went home to bed. Lying in the dark, he took up the thread again and for 2 hours tried to understand what it was he wanted to articulate. Salander smoked a cigarette, comfortably leaning back in the chair in front of him. She crossed her right leg over her left and fixed him with her gaze. Sandström had never seen such an intense look before. When she spoke, her voice was still soft.
In January 2003, you visited Ines Hamuljärvi for the first time at her apartment in Norsborg. She had just turned 16. Why did you visit her?
Sandström did not know how to answer. He could hardly make sense of it himself, how it had begun, or why he... She raised the taser.
I don't know. I wanted her. She was so beautiful.
Beautiful?
Yes, she was beautiful.
And you thought that you had the right to tie her to the bed and fuck her?
She went along with it. I swear, she went along with it.
You paid her?
Sandström bit his tongue.
No.
Why not? She was a whore. Whores get paid.
She was a present.
A present?
Her voice had taken on a dangerous tone.
It was in return for a favour I did someone.
Per Ocker,
Salander said in a reasonable tone,
you wouldn't be trying to avoid answering my question, would you?
I swear, I'll answer anything you ask. I won't lie.
Good. What favour? And who was it for?
I'd smuggled in some anabolic steroids. I was on a business trip to Estonia, and I brought the pills back in my car. The guy I went with was called Harry Ranta, although he didn't come with me in the car.
How did you meet Harry Ranta?
I've known him for years, since the '80s, in fact. He's a friend. We used to go to bars together.
And it was Harry Ranta who offered you Ines Hamuljärvi as... a present?
Yes. No, I'm sorry, that was later, here in Stockholm. It was his brother, Ator Ranta.
So you're saying that Ator Ranta knocked on your door and asked if you wanted to drive to Norsborg and fuck Ines?
No. I was at... we had a party in... damn, I can't remember where we were.
He was suddenly shaking uncontrollably and felt his knees begin to give way. He needed to brace his legs against something to stand upright.
"Answer calmly," Salander said. "I'm not going to hang you because you need time to collect your thoughts. But the minute I get the idea you're trying to dodge a question, then... pow!"
She raised her eyebrows and, to his astonishment, looked angelic. As angelic as anyone could look behind such a hideous mask. Sandström swallowed. His mouth was dry as a bone, and he could feel the rope tightening around his neck.
Where you went drinking isn't important. How come Otto Ranta offered you Ines?
We were talking about... I told him that I wanted...
He realized he was crying.
You said that you wanted to have one of his whores.
He nodded.
I was drunk. He said that she needed...
What was it she needed?
Otto said that she needed punishment. She was difficult. She didn't do what he wanted.
And what did he want her to do?
Whore for him. He offered me. I was drunk and didn't know what I was doing. I didn't mean... Forgive me.
He snuffled.
It's not me you need to ask for forgiveness. So you offered to help Otto punish Ines, and the two of you drove over to her place.
That's not how it was.
Tell me how it was. Why did you go with Otto to her place?
She balanced the taser on her knee. He was shaking again.
I went because I wanted to have her. She was there, and she was available. Ines lived with a girlfriend of Harry Ranta's. I don't think I ever knew her name. Otto tied Ines to the bed, and I had sex with her. Otto watched.
No, you didn't have sex with her. You raped her.
He said nothing.
Or what?
He nodded.
What did Ines say?
She didn't say anything.
Did she protest?
He shook his head.
So she thought it was cool that a middle-aged dickwad tied her up and fucked her.
She was drunk. She didn't care.
Sarander sighed in resignation.
Okay. And then you kept on going to visit Ines.
She was so... She wanted me.
Bullshit.
He looked at Sarander in despair. Then he nodded.
I raped her. Harry and Atel had given permission. They wanted her to be trained.
Did you pay them?
He nodded.
How much?
It was a friendly deal. I helped out with the smuggling.
How much?
A few grand altogether.
In one of your pictures, Ines is here in the apartment.
Harry brought her here.
He snuffled again.
So, for a few thousand, you got a girl you could do with as you pleased. How many times did you rape her?
I don't know. Several times.
Okay. Who runs this gang?
They're going to kill me if I rat on them.
I don't give a shit. Right now, I'm a much bigger problem for you than the Ranta brothers.
She held up the taser.
Otto. He's the older one. Harry is the fixer.
How many more are there in the gang?
I only know Harry and Otto. Otto's girl is in it, too. And a guy called... I don't know. Pelle, something. He's Swedish. I don't know who he is. He's a junkie who runs errands for them.
Otto's girl?
Sylvia. She's a whore.
Sarander sat for a moment, thinking. Then she raised her eyes.
Who is Zala?
Sandstrom turned pale.
The same question that Svensson had hounded him about.
He said nothing for so long that he noticed the girl was getting pissed off.
I don't know,
he said.
I don't know who he is.
Salander's expression darkened.
You've been doing fine up to now. Don't throw away your only chance, she said.
I swear to God, honest, I don't know who he is. The journalist you shot...
He stopped. It might not be a good idea to bring up her massacre in Enschede.
Yes?
He asked me the same thing. I don't know. If I knew, I'd tell you. I swear. He's somebody Otto knows.
You've talked to him?
Just for a minute once on the phone. I talked to someone who said his name was Zala. Or rather, he talked to me.
Why?
Sandstrom blinked. Drops of sweat were running into his eyes and he could feel snot running down his chin.
They wanted me to do them another favour.
The story is getting annoyingly slow, Sarander said.
They wanted me to take another trip to Tallinn and bring back a car that was prepared already. Amphetamines. I didn't want to do it.
Why not?
It was too much. They were such gangsters. I wanted out.
I had a job to get on with. So you think you were just a gangster in your free time?
I'm not really like that.
Oh, right.
Her voice contained such contempt that Sandstrom closed his eyes.
Keep going. How did Zella come into the picture?
It was a nightmare.
The tears were running again. He bit his lip so hard that it began to bleed.
Boring,
Salander said.
Otto kept after me about it. Harry warned me and said that Otto was getting angry and that he didn't know how it would pan out. Finally, I agreed to meet Otto. That was in August of last year. I drove to Norsborg with Harry.
His mouth kept moving, but the words disappeared. Salander's eyes narrowed. He found his voice again.
Otto was a nutcase. He's very brutal. You have no idea how brutal he can be. He said it was too late for me to pull out, and that if I didn't do as he said, I wouldn't be allowed to live. He was going to give me a demonstration.
Oh, yeah?
They forced me to go with them. We drove towards Södertälje. Otto told me to put on a hood. It was a bag that he tied over my eyes. I was scared to death.
So you were in a car with a bag over your head. Then what happened?
The car stopped. I didn't know where I was.
Where did they put the bag on you?
Just before Södertälje.
And how long did it take you to get there?
Maybe half an hour. They got me out of the car. It was some sort of warehouse.
What happened?
Harry and Otto led me inside. There were lights on. The first thing I saw was some poor guy lying on a cement floor. He was tied up. He'd been beaten really badly.
Who was it?
His name was Kenneth Gustafsson. But I didn't find that out until later.
What happened?
There was a man there. He was the biggest man I've ever seen. Enormous. Nothing but muscle.
What did he look like?
He looked like the devil himself. Blonde.
Name?
He never said his name.
Okay. A big, blonde guy. Who else?
There was another man. He looked stressed. Hair in a ponytail.
Maggie Lundin. More?
Plus me and Harry and Otto.
Keep going.
The huge guy. He set out a chair for me. He didn't say a word. It was Otto who did the talking. He said that the guy on the floor was a snitch. He wanted me to know what happened to people who made trouble.
Sandstrom was blubbering unrestrainedly.
The big guy lifted the other guy off the floor and put him on another chair facing me. We were sitting a yard or so apart. I looked him in the eyes, then the giant stood behind him and put his hands around his neck. He...
Strangled him?
Yeah. No, he squeezed him to death. I think he broke his neck with his bare hands. I heard the guy's neck snap and he died right in front of me.
Sandstrom was swaying on the rope. Tears were streaming down his face. He had never told anyone this before. Salander gave him a minute to collect himself.
And then?
The other guy, the one with the ponytail, started up a chainsaw and sawed off the guy's head and then his hands. After that, the giant came up to me. He put his hands around my neck. I tried to pull his hands away. I pulled as hard as I could, but I couldn't budge him an inch. But he didn't squeeze. He just held his hands there for a long time. Meanwhile, Otto took out his mobile and made a call in Russian. Then he said that Zella wanted to talk to me and held the phone to my ear.
What did Zella say?
He just asked whether I still wanted to pull out. I promised to go to Tallinn and get the car with the amphetamines. What else could I do?
Salander sat, without speaking, for a long time. She contemplated the snuffling journalist on the rope and seemed to be thinking about something.
Describe his voice.
It sounded normal.
Deep voice? High voice?
Deep. Ordinary. Gruff.
What language did he speak?
Swedish.
Accent?
Yeah, maybe a little. But good Swedish. He and Otto spoke Russian.
Do you understand Russian?
A little. Not fluent, just a little.
What did Otto say to him?
He said that the demonstration was over.
Have you told anyone else about this?
No.
Svensson?
No. No.
Svensson visited you?
Sandstrom nodded.
I can't hear you.
Yes.
How come?
He knew that I had...
The horse. What did he ask?
He wanted to know. About Zella. He asked about Zella. That was the second visit.
The second visit?
He got in touch 2 weeks before he died. That was the first visit. Then he came back 2 days before you... He...
Before I shot him?
Yes.
And he asked about Zella then?
Yeah.
What did you tell him?
Nothing. I couldn't tell him anything. I admitted that I'd spoken to him on the phone. That was all. I didn't say anything about the blonde monster or what they did to Gustafsson.
Okay. Tell me exactly what Svensson asked.
He just wanted to know what I knew about Zella, that was all.
And you didn't tell him anything?
Nothing of any use. I don't know anything.
She bit her lower lip pensively.
There was something he wasn't saying. Who did you tell about Svensson's visit?
Sandstrom seemed to shiver. Salander waved the taser.
I called Harry.
When?
He swallowed.
The night Svensson visited me the first time.
She kept on for another half hour, but he was just repeating himself, adding details here and there. She stood up and put a hand on the rope.
"You must be one of the sorriest perverts I've ever met,"
Salander said.
"What you did to Inez deserves the death penalty. But I told you that you would live if you answered my questions. I keep my promises."
She loosened the knot. Sandstrom collapsed in a slobbering heap on the floor. He saw her put a stool on his coffee table and climb up and unhook the block and tackle. She coiled the rope and stuffed it in a backpack. She went into the bathroom. He heard the water running. When she came back, she had washed off the makeup. Her face looked scrubbed and naked.
"You can cut yourself free."
She dropped a kitchen knife beside him. He heard her out in the hall for a long time. It sounded as though she was changing clothes. Then he heard the front door open and close. It took him half an hour to cut off the tape. He first sank down on the sofa, then staggered to his feet and searched the apartment. She had taken his Colt 1911 government. Salander arrived home at 4:55 a.m. She took off the Irene Nessa wig and went straight to bed without turning on her computer to see whether Blomqvist had solved the mystery of the missing police report. She was awake at 9 and spent all of Tuesday digging up information about the Ranta brothers. Otto Ranta had an extensive record in the police criminal files. He was a Finnish citizen from an Estonian family. He came to Sweden in 1971. From 1972 to 1978 he worked as a carpenter for Skånska Concrete Pouring. He was dismissed after being caught stealing from a building site and sentenced to 7 months in prison. Between 1980 and 1982 he worked for a smaller builder. He was kicked out after turning up drunk at work several times. For the remainder of the 80s he made a living as a bouncer, a technician at a company that serviced oil-fired boilers, a dishwasher, and a janitor at a school. He was fired from all these jobs for drunkenness or for getting into fights. His janitorial job lasted only a few months. A teacher reported him for sexual harassment and threatening behaviour. In 1987 he was fined and sentenced to a month in prison for car theft, driving without insurance, and receiving stolen property. The following year he was fined for possession of an illegal weapon. In 1990 he was convicted of a sexual offence that wasn't specified in his criminal record. In 1991 he was charged with intimidation but acquitted. The same year he was fined and put on probation for smuggling alcohol. He served 3 months in 1992 for beating up his girlfriend and making threats against her sister. He managed to stay out of trouble until 1997 when he was convicted of handling stolen goods and aggravated assault. This time he got 10 months in prison. Harry, his younger brother, followed him to Sweden in 1982 and worked in a warehouse for a long time. His criminal record showed 3 convictions. In 1990 for insurance fraud, in 1992 with a sentence of 2 years for aggravated assault, receiving stolen property, theft and rape. He was deported to Finland, but in 1996 returned to Sweden when he was once more sentenced to 10 months in prison for aggravated assault and rape. The verdict was appealed, and the appeals court acquitted him on the rape charge. but the conviction for assault was upheld and he served 6 months. In 2000 he was charged again, this time for intimidation and rape. The charges were later dropped, and the case dismissed. Salander traced their last known addresses. Atto's was in Norsborg, Harry's in Albi. Paolo Roberto got Miriam Wu's answering machine for the 15th time. He'd been to the address on Lundegarten several times already that day. No one answered when he rang her doorbell. It was past 8 on Tuesday evening. She had to come home sometime, damn it. He understood that Wu would want to stay out of sight, but the worst of the media blitz had subsided. He might as well sit outside the door of her building in case she turned up, even if it was only for a change of clothing. He filled a thermos with coffee and made himself some sandwiches. Before he left his apartment, he made the sign of the cross in front of the crucifix and the Madonna. He parked about 100 feet from the entrance on Lundegarten and pushed back the seat to make more room for his legs. He played the radio at a low volume. He taped up a photograph of Wu that he'd cut out of a newspaper. She looked great, he thought. He patiently watched the few people walking past. Miriam Wu was not one of them. Every 10 minutes he dialed her number. He gave up trying to call at around 9, when his mobile told him that the battery was almost dead. Sandström spent Tuesday in a state approaching apathy. He had slept the night on the sofa in the living room, incapable of going to bed and unable to stop the sobbing fits that regularly overcame him. On Tuesday morning he went down to Systembolaget in Solna and bought a bottle of Skåne Aquavit. Then he went back to his sofa and drank half of it. Not until later did he come to a clear understanding of his situation and begin to consider what he could do about it. He wished that he had never heard of the Ranta brothers and their whores. He could not believe that he had been so stupid as to let himself be enticed to the apartment in Norsborg, where Atto had tied the heavily drugged Ines Hamurjärvi to a bed with her legs spread, then challenged him about who had the bigger rod. They had taken turns, and he had won the contest for the greater number of sexual feats performed that night. The girl woke up once and tried to resist. Atto spent half an hour alternating between slapping her and filling her with drink, after which she was pacified and he invited Sandström to continue the sport. Fucking whore. How could he have been so stupid? He could hardly expect any mercy from Millennium. They made their living with that type of scandal. He was scared to death of the mad woman Salander, not to mention that blonde monster. Obviously he couldn't go to the police. He wasn't going to be able to manage on his own, and the problem wasn't going to go away by itself. There was only one slim possibility open to him, one place where he could expect an ounce of sympathy and maybe a solution of sorts. He was clutching at straws, but it was his only option. That afternoon he gathered his courage and called Harry Ranta's mobile. There was no answer. He kept trying until 10 that night. After thinking about the matter for a long time, and fortifying himself with the rest of the aquavit, he called Atto Ranta. It was Atto's girlfriend, Sylvia, who answered. She told him that the Ranta brothers were on vacation in Tallinn. No, she did not know how to reach them. No, she had no idea when they would be back. They would be in Estonia for quite a while. She sounded glad of that. Sandström wasn't sure if he was depressed or relieved. It meant that he didn't have to explain things to Atto, but the underlying message, that the Ranta brothers had decided to take a breather in Tallinn for the foreseeable future, did not do much to calm Sandström's nerves. Chapter 25 Tuesday, April 5th, to Wednesday, April 6th. Paolo Roberto had not gone to sleep, but he was so deeply immersed in his thoughts that it was a moment before he noticed the woman walking down from Hergelid Church after 11 p.m. He saw her in his rear-view mirror. Not until she passed under a street-light about 70 yards behind him did he snap his head around and at once recognize that it was Miriam Wu. He sat up in his seat. His immediate thought was to get out of the car, but he might scare her off. It was better to wait until she reached the front door. As he watched her approach, he saw a dark-coloured van pull up next to her. Paolo Roberto looked on, horrified, as a man, a devilishly huge beast, hopped out from the sliding doors and grabbed Wu. She was taken completely by surprise. She tried to wriggle away by backing up, but the man held her wrists in a vice-like grip. Paolo Roberto's mouth dropped open when he saw Wu's leg come up in a fast arc.
"She's a kickboxer."
She landed a blow on the man's head, but it didn't seem to faze him in the least. Instead, the man raised his hand and slapped Wu on the side of her head. Paolo Roberto heard the blow from where he was sitting. Wu hit the deck as if struck by lightning. The man bent down, picked her up with one hand, and simply tossed her into the van. That was when Paolo Roberto closed his mouth and came to life. He threw open the car door and sprinted towards the van. After only a few steps, he realized how fruitless it was. The van that Miriam Wu had been thrown into, like a sack of potatoes, had made a U-turn and was already moving down the street before he reached full speed. It was headed towards Hergelid Church. Aldo Roberto spun around and raced back to his car. He, too, made a U-turn. The van had vanished when he came to the corner. He braked, looked down Hergelidsgarten, and then took a chance and turned left, towards Hornsgarten. When he reached Hornsgarten, he came up against a red light, but there was no traffic, so he eased into the intersection and looked around. The only taillights he could see were turning left up towards Lilholmsbrunn at Longholmsgarten. He could not see if it was the van, but it was the only vehicle in sight. He accelerated in pursuit, but was stopped by the lights at Longholmsgarten and had to let the traffic from Kungsholmen pass as the seconds ticked away. When the traffic cleared, he accelerated hard, ignoring another red light. He drove as fast as he dared across Liljeholmsbrunn, and faster as he passed through Liljeholmen. He didn't know if it was the van whose tail lights he had seen, and he didn't know whether it had turned off to Grundal or Orsta. He decided to go straight and floored it again. He was doing more than 90 miles an hour and blew past the sluggish, law-abiding traffic, assuming some driver or other would take down his license plate number. When he reached Bredeng, he spotted the vehicle again. He closed in until he was only 50 yards behind and was sure it was the van. He slowed to about 50 miles an hour and fell back to 200 yards. Only then did he start breathing normally. Miriam Wu felt the blood running down her neck as she landed on the floor of the van. Her nose was bleeding. He had split her lower lip and probably broken her nose. The attack had come like a bolt out of the blue. Her resistance had been quashed in less than a second. She felt the van start up as soon as her attacker slid the doors shut. For a moment, as the driver turned the van, the blonde giant lost his balance. She twisted around and braced her hips against the floor. When the man turned towards her, she lashed out with a kick, striking him on the side of his head. She even saw that her heel left a mark. It was a kick that should have hurt. He looked at her in surprise, then he smiled.
"Jesus, what kind of a fucking monster is this?"
She kicked again, but he caught her leg and twisted her foot so hard that she shrieked in pain and had to roll over onto her stomach. Then he leaned over and slapped her again. He hit the side of her head. Wu saw stars. It felt like being struck by a sledgehammer. He sat on her back. She tried to lift him, but she could not move him an inch. He twisted her arms behind her back and locked them in handcuffs. She was helpless. Suddenly she felt a paralyzing fear. Blomqvist was passing the Globe Arena on his way home from Tirso. He had spent the afternoon and evening visiting people on Svensson's list. Not a thing had come of it. He had encountered panic-stricken men who had already been confronted by Svensson and were just waiting for the sky to fall. They had begged and pleaded with him. He crossed all of them off his private list of murder suspects. He took out his mobile as he drove across Skanstulsbrunn and called Berger. She didn't answer. He tried Ericsson. No answer there, either. Damn. It was late. He wanted to talk about this with somebody. He wondered whether Paolo Roberto had had any success with Miriam Wu and dialed his number. It rang 5 times before he got an answer.
Paolo!
Hi, it's Blomqvist. I'm wondering how it went.
Blomqvist! Home on, scritch, scritch, a van with Miriam.
I can't hear you.
Scrap, scrap, scrap.
You're breaking up, I can't hear you. Then the connection broke off. Paolo Roberto swore. His battery died just as he went through Ficcia. He pushed the on button and brought the phone back to life. He dialed the number for emergency services, but as soon as they answered, his mobile went dead again. Shit. He had a battery charger that worked in the cigarette lighter, but the charger was in the hall at home. He tossed the mobile onto the passenger seat and concentrated on keeping the taillights of the van in sight. He was driving a BMW with a full tank, and there wasn't a chance in hell that the van would be able to outrun him, but he didn't want to attract attention, so he increased the distance to several hundred yards.
A giant on steroids beats up a girl right in front of me. Just wait till I get my hands on that fucker.
If Erika Berger had been there, she would have called him a macho cowboy. Paolo Roberto called it being pissed off. Blomqvist drove down Lundegarten. Miriam Wu's apartment was in darkness. He tried calling Paolo Roberto again, but got the message that the subscriber could not be reached. He swore to himself and then drove home and made coffee and a sandwich. The drive took longer than Paolo Roberto had anticipated. The van went as far as Södertälje before it headed west on the E20 towards Strängnäs. Just past Nykvarn, it turned off to the left onto smaller roads through the countryside of Sörmland. The smaller the roads, the greater the risk that he would be noticed by the men in the van. He eased off the accelerator and fell back even more. He was unsure of his geography out here, but as far as he could tell, they were passing to the west of Lake Ingern. He lost the van from view and went faster. He came out on a long straightaway. The van had disappeared. There were small roads on both sides. He had lost them. Miriam Wu felt pain in her neck and face, but she had overcome her panic at being helpless. He had not hit her again. She had managed to sit up and was leaning against the back of the driver's seat. Her hands were cuffed behind her back, and there was a strip of duct tape over her mouth. One nostril was clogged with blood, and she was having difficulty breathing. She looked at her assailant. Since he had taped her mouth, he hadn't said a word. She looked at the mark where she had kicked him. It was a blow that should have caused serious damage. He seemed hardly to have noticed it. He was massively built, and on a huge scale. He had muscles that spoke of long hours spent in a gym. But he was not a bodybuilder. His muscles looked completely natural. His hands were as big as frying pans. The van was bumping along a road full of potholes. She thought they had taken the E4 south for a long time before they turned off onto country roads. She knew that even if her hands were free, she wouldn't stand a chance against this giant. Ericsson called Blomqvist a little before midnight.
"I'm sorry for calling so late. I've been trying to reach you for hours, but you didn't answer your mobile."
"I had it turned off all day while I was dealing with some of the Johns."
"I came up with something that could be of interest," Ericsson said.
"Tell me."
"Bjermann. You asked me to look into his background."
"What did you find?"
"He was born in 1950 and began studying law in 1970. He took his law degree in 1976, started working at Klang and Reiner in 1978, and opened his own practice in 1989. One of his side jobs was as a clerk at a district court for a few weeks in 1976. Right after he got his degree in 1976, he worked for 2 years, from 1976 to 1978, as a lawyer at National Police Headquarters."
"Interesting."
"I checked out what sort of work he did there. It wasn't easy to dig up. But he was, for one thing, in charge of legal matters for the security police. He worked on immigration."
"Which tells us?"
"That he worked there with your man Björk."
"That bastard. He didn't say a word about having actually worked with Bjermann."
The van had to be somewhere in the vicinity. Paolo Roberto had glimpsed it only a minute before he lost it. He reversed onto the grass verge and turned back. He drove slowly, looking for side roads. After only 150 yards, he spotted a light glinting through a narrow gap in the curtain of trees. He saw a forest track on the opposite side of the road and drove up it about 50 feet, turned and parked facing out, not bothering to lock the car. Then he jogged back across the road and hopped over a ditch. He wished he had a flashlight as he wound his way forward through the undergrowth and low branches. Very soon he came out onto a sandy gravel area and could see some low, dark buildings. As he walked towards them, the light above a loading bay came on. He dropped to his knees and stayed motionless. A second later, the lights went on inside the building. It appeared to be a warehouse, about 100 feet long, with a row of narrow windows high on one side. The yard was full of containers, and to his right was parked a yellow front-end loader. Next to it was a white Volvo. In the glow of the outdoor light, he suddenly saw the van, parked only 25 yards from where he crouched. Then a door opened in the loading bay right in front of him. A man with mousy hair and a beer belly came out of the warehouse and lit a cigarette. Paolo Roberto saw, against the light from the door, that he had a ponytail. He kept stock still. He was in full view, less than 20 yards from the man, but the flame from his cigarette lighter had knocked out his night vision. Then he and the man with the ponytail both heard a half-choked howl from the van. As Ponytail moved towards the van, Paolo Roberto eased himself down flat on the ground. He heard a rattle as the sliding doors of the van opened and saw the huge blonde man get out, reach back inside and haul out Miriam Wu. He took her under one arm and held her in an easy grip as she struggled. The two men exchanged some words, but Paolo Roberto could not hear what they said. Then Ponytail opened the door on the driver's side and hopped in. He started up the van and made a tight turn in the yard. The beams of the headlights swung past only a few yards from Paolo Roberto. The van disappeared down an access road, and the noise of its engine faded into the distance. The giant carried Miriam Wu through the door in the loading bay. Paolo Roberto could see a shadow through the windows high on the wall. It seemed as if the shadow was moving towards the far end of the building. He got up cautiously. His clothes felt sticky. He was relieved and uneasy. He was relieved because he had managed to track the van and had Miriam Wu within reach, but he was in awe of the giant who had plucked her out of the van as if she were a bag of groceries. The sane thing to do would be to retreat and call the police, but his battery was dead and he had only a vague idea of where he was. He certainly couldn't give directions to anyone else as to how to get there, and he had no clue what was happening to the girl inside the building. He made a slow circuit and discovered that there was only one entrance. After 2 minutes he was back near the door and had to make a decision. No question that the giant was a bad guy. He had kidnapped Miriam Wu. Paolo Roberto did not feel particularly afraid. He had great self-confidence and knew that he could give as good as he got if it came to a fight. The question was whether the man inside the warehouse was armed, and whether there were other people with him. He hesitated. There shouldn't be any others, besides the girl and the blonde giant. The loading bay was wide enough for a front-end loader to drive through it, and there was a normal-sized door fitted into the gate. Paolo Roberto walked over and pressed down the handle to open it. He entered a big warehouse bathed in light, filled with assorted building materials, crushed boxes, and trash. Miriam Wu felt tears running down her cheeks. She was crying not so much from pain as from helplessness. During the journey the giant had handled her as if she weighed nothing at all. He ripped the tape off her mouth when the van stopped. He lifted her and carried her inside without the least effort and dumped her on the cement floor, paying no heed to her protests. When he looked at her, his eyes were ice cold. Miriam Wu knew that she was going to die in this warehouse. He turned his back on her and walked to a table where he opened a bottle of mineral water, drinking from it in long gulps. He had not taped her legs together, and she attempted to stand up. He turned to her and smiled. He was closer to the door than she was. She would have no chance of making it past him. Resigned, she sank to her knees, furious at herself.
"I'll be damned if I give up without a fight."
She got up again and clenched her teeth.
"Come on, you fucking tub of lard."
She felt clumsy and off balance with her hands cuffed behind her, but when he came towards her, she backed, circling away, watching for an opening. She lashed out with a lightning kick to his ribs, wheeled around and kicked again at his crotch. She hit his hip, backed off a few feet, and switched legs for the next kick. With her hands manacled, she did not have the balance to kick at his face, but she delivered a swift kick to his breastbone. He reached out a hand and grabbed her by the shoulder, spun her around and gave her a single blow with his fist, not very hard, to the kidneys. Miriam Wu shrieked like a madwoman as a paralyzing pain sliced through her midsection. She sank to her knees again. He gave her one more slap to the side of her head and she tumbled to the floor. Then he kicked her in the torso. She gasped for breath as she heard a rib crack. Paolo Roberto saw nothing of the beating, but he did hear Miriam Wu wail in pain, a sharp, shrill scream that was immediately cut off. He looked in the direction of the sound and clenched his teeth. There was a room beyond a dividing wall. He moved silently through the warehouse and peered through the doorway just as the man rolled the girl onto her back. The giant vanished from his field of view for a few seconds and came back with a chainsaw, which he set on the floor in front of her. Paolo Roberto slipped off his jacket.
"I want the answer to a simple question."
He had a high-pitched voice, almost as if it had never broken, and an accent.
"Where is Lisbeth Salander?"
"I don't know," Miriam Wu said, obviously in pain.
"That's the wrong answer. You'll have one more chance before I start this thing."
He squatted down and patted the chainsaw.
"Where is Lisbeth Salander hiding?"
Wu shook her head. When the man reached for the chainsaw, Paolo Roberto took three determined strides into the room and threw a hard right hook at his kidneys. Paolo Roberto had not become a world-famous boxer by being tentative in the ring. He had fought 33 bouts in his professional career, and won 28 of them. When he punched someone as hard as he could, he expected to see his opponent feel pain. But this time he felt as if he had smashed his hand into a concrete wall. He had never experienced anything like it in all the years he'd spent as a boxer. He looked in astonishment at the colossus in front of him. The man turned and looked with equal astonishment at the boxer.
"What do you say we find you somebody in your own weight class?" said Paolo Roberto.
He got off a string of right-left-right punches to the body and put some muscle behind them. They were heavy blows. The only effect was that the giant took half a step back, more from surprise than from the effect of the punches. Then he smiled.
"You're Paolo Roberto,"
he said. Paolo Roberto stopped, amazed. He had just landed four punches that should have put the giant on the deck while the referee counted 10, but his blows seemed not to have the slightest effect.
"Good God, this isn't normal."
Then he saw, as if in slow motion, the man's right hook come flying towards him. He was slow and telegraphed the punch in advance. Paolo Roberto had time to move, but the blow glanced off his shoulder. It felt as if he had been hit by a steel bar. Paolo Roberto backed up two steps, filled with new respect for his opponent.
"There's something wrong with him. Nobody can hit this hard."
He automatically blocked a left hook with his forearm and felt at once a sharp pain. He did not manage to block the right hook that came out of nowhere and landed on his forehead. Paolo Roberto tumbled backwards out the door. He landed against a mound of wooden pallets and shook his head. He felt blood streaming down his face.
"He cut my eyebrow. It'll have to be sewn up. Again."
In the next moment the giant came into view, and Paolo Roberto instinctively twisted to the side. He escaped by a hair's breadth, another club-like blow from those enormous fists. He quickly backed up, 3-4 shuffles, and got his arms up in a defensive position. He was shaken. The man regarded him with eyes that were curious and almost amused. Then he assumed the same defensive position.
"This guy is a boxer."
They began to circle each other slowly. The 180 seconds that followed became the most bizarre match that Paolo Roberto had ever fought. There were no coaches, no referee. There was no bell to call a halt to the round and send the fighters to their corners. No pause for water and smelling salts and a towel to wipe the blood from his eyes. Paolo Roberto knew now that he was fighting for his life. All his training, all the years of hammering on punching bags, all the sparring and all the experience from all the bouts he had fought came together as the adrenaline pumped in a way he had never before experienced. They went at each other in an exchange into which Paolo Roberto put all his power and all his fury. Left, right, left, left again, and a jab with the right to the face, duck the left hook, back up a step, attack with the right. Every punch landed with solid force. He was in the biggest battle of his life. He was hitting with his brain as much as with his fists. He managed to avoid every punch his opponent threw at him. He landed a right hook, clear as a bell, to the jaw that felt like he had broken a bone in his hand, and that should have made his opponent collapse in a heap. He glanced at his knuckles and saw that they were bloody. He could see bruises and a swollen area on the giant's face, but his opponent seemed not even to feel the blows. Paolo Roberto backed up, breathed as steadily as he could, and took stock.
"He's no boxer. He moves like a boxer, but he can't box for shit. He's only pretending. He can't block. He telegraphs his punches. And he's as slow as a tortoise."
In the next instant, the giant got in a left hook to the side of Paolo Roberto's ribcage. That was the second time he had connected well. Paolo Roberto felt pain shoot through his body as a rib cracked. Again he backed away, but he tripped over a part of scaffolding and fell on his back. He saw the giant towering over him, but he flung himself into a roll to the side and staggered to his feet. He squared up, trying to gather his strength, but the man was on him again. He ducked, ducked again, and backed away, feeling terrible pain each time he parried a blow with his shoulder. Then came the moment that every boxer has experienced with dread. The feeling that could turn up any time in the middle of a bout. The feeling of just not being good enough. The realization that you are about to lose. That's the crux of almost every fight. The moment when the strength drains out of you and the adrenaline pumps so hard that it becomes a burden and surrender appears like a ghost at ringside. That's the moment that separates the pros from the amateurs and the winner from the loser. Few boxers who find themselves at the edge of that abyss manage to turn the match around, turn certain defeat into victory. Paolo Roberto was struck by this insight. He felt a roaring in his head that made him dizzy, and he experienced the moment as if he were watching the scene from outside, peering at this giant through a camera lens. This was the moment when it was a matter of winning or disappearing for good. He backed in a wide semicircle to collect his strength and buy time. The man followed him steadily but slowly, precisely as though he knew that the outcome was decided, but he wanted to draw the round out.
"He boxes, but he can't really box. He knows who I am. He's a rank amateur. But he has a devastating power in his punch, and he seems insensitive to all punishment."
These thoughts rattled around in Paolo Roberto's head as he tried to decide what to do. Suddenly he was reliving the night in Mariham, 2 years before, when his career as a professional boxer had ended in the most brutal way. He had met the Argentine Sebastián Luján, or rather, Sebastián Luján met him. Paolo Roberto had walked into the first knockout of his life, and had been unconscious for 15 seconds. He often thought about what had gone wrong. He was in tip-top shape, he was focused, but the Argentine had landed a solid punch, and the round had been transformed into a raging sea. Watching the video afterwards, he saw how he had staggered around the ring as defenseless as Donald Duck. The knockout came 23 seconds later. Sebastián Luján hadn't been any better or better trained than he was. The margins of error being so small, the bout could have gone either way. The only difference he could detect later was that Luján had been hungrier. When Paolo Roberto went into that ring in Mariham, he was set on winning, but he wasn't dying to box. It did not mean life or death anymore. A loss was not a catastrophe. 1.5 years later, he was still a boxer, but he was no longer a pro, and he only took on friendly sparring matches. He went on training, and he had not put on weight or gone soft in the gut. He was not as well-tuned an instrument as before a title bout, for which his body had been drilled for months, but he was Paolo Roberto, and not some nobody. And unlike Mariham, the bout in the warehouse south of Nykvarn literally meant life or death. He made a decision. He stopped short and let the giant come in close. He feinted with his left and put everything he had behind a right hook. He lashed out with a punch that hit the man across the mouth and nose. His attack was totally unexpected, since he had been in retreat for the past few moments. He heard something give way. He followed up with a left-right-left and landed all three in the man's face. The man was boxing in slow motion. He struck back with his right. Paolo Roberto saw the punch coming far in advance and ducked under the huge fist. He saw the giant shift his body weight and knew that he was going to follow up with a left. Instead of blocking, Paolo Roberto leaned back and let the left hook pass in front of his nose. He replied with a massive blow to the body just below the ribs. When the man turned to meet the attack, Paolo Roberto's left hook came up and hit him across the nose again. He suddenly felt that everything he was doing was utterly right and that he was in control of the bout. The giant backed away. His nose was bleeding. He was not smiling now. Then the giant kicked him. His foot shot up and took Paolo Roberto by surprise. He'd not been expecting a kick. It felt as if a sledgehammer had hit his thigh just above the knee, and pain ran right through his leg. No. He took a step back, and his right leg gave way. He was on his back. The giant looked down at him. For a second, their eyes met. The message was unmistakable. The fight was over. Then the giant's eyes widened as Miriam Wu kicked him in the crotch from behind. Every muscle in Miriam Wu's body was aching, but somehow she had managed to slip her bound hands underneath her and then, agonizingly, over her feet so that she got her arms in front of her body. She had pain in her ribs, neck, back, and kidneys, and only with difficulty did she get to her feet. Finally, she wobbled to the door and looked on wide-eyed as Paolo Roberto, where did he come from, hit the giant with a right hook and then a combination to the face before he was kicked to the ground. Miriam Wu realized that she could not care less how or why Paolo Roberto had shown up. He was one of the good guys. But for the first time in her life, she felt a murderous desire to damage another human being. She took a few quick steps forward, mobilizing every bit of energy and all the muscles she had intact. She came up to the giant from behind and landed a kick in his balls. It may not have been elegant Thai boxing, but the kick had the desired effect. Miriam Wu nodded to herself. Men could be as big as a house and made of granite, but they all had balls in the same place. For the first time, the man looked shaken. He gave a moan, grabbed at his crotch, and went down on one knee. Wu stood indecisive until she realized that she had to do more to try to end this. She was going to kick him in the face, but to her amazement, he lifted an arm. It should have been impossible for him to recover so fast. And it had felt like kicking a tree trunk. He grabbed her foot, dragged her down, and began to haul her in. She saw him raise a fist, and she twisted desperately, kicking with her free leg. She hit him above the ear at the same instant his blow struck her on the temple. She saw lightning and blackness alternating before her eyes. The giant began to scramble to his feet. That was when Paolo Roberto swung a plank into the back of his head. The man fell forward and landed with a crash. Paolo Roberto looked around as if in a dream. The giant was writhing on the floor. The girl had a glassy look and seemed to be totally drained. Their combined efforts had brought them only a brief respite. Paolo Roberto could barely support himself on his injured leg, and he was afraid that a muscle had torn just above his knee. He limped over to Miriam Wu and pulled her to her feet. She began to move again, but her eyes could not seem to focus. Without a word, he slung her over his shoulder and started hobbling towards the door. The pain in his right knee was acute. It was exhilarating to come out into the dark, cold air, but he had no time to pause. He navigated across the yard and into the curtain of woods, the same way he had come. He was no sooner in the trees than he tripped over a root and tumbled to the ground. Miriam Wu moaned, and he heard the door of the warehouse slam open with a crash. The giant was a monumental silhouette in the bright rectangle of the doorway. Paolo Roberto put a hand over the girl's mouth. He bent down and whispered in her ear to be utterly still and quiet. Then he groped among the roots of a fallen tree and found a stone that was bigger than his fist. He made the sign of the cross. For the first time in his sinful life, he was ready to kill another human being, if it proved necessary. He was so shattered that he knew he would not be able to go another round. But nobody, not even a freak of nature, could go on fighting with a crushed skull. He squeezed the rock and felt that it was oval-shaped with a sharp edge. The man went unsteadily to the corner of the building and then made a long sweep across the yard. He stopped less than 10 paces from where Paolo Roberto was holding his breath. He listened and peered around, but he could only guess which way they had disappeared into the night. After a few minutes, he seemed to realize that the search was futile. He went back into the building with quick determination and was gone for a minute or so. He turned off the lights and then came out with a bag and walked over to the Volvo. He drove off down the access road. Paolo Roberto listened until he could no longer hear the sound of the engine. When he looked down, he saw a pair of eyes gleaming in the dark.
"Hi, Miriam," he said. "My name is Paolo. You don't have to be afraid of me."
"I know."
Her voice was weak. He slumped, exhausted, against the fallen tree and felt his adrenaline dropping to zero.
"I don't know how I'm going to get up," he said, "but I have a car on the other side of the main road."
The blond giant was shaken and dazed and had a strange feeling in his head. He braked and turned into a side road.